Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
And welcome back. Bernard Phelan is with us in studio. Bernard had been to Iran a couple of times prior to his visit in September 2022, and he ended up being arrested and imprisoned for 222 days. Think of that for a moment. And during that time, he did not know if or when he would be released. His family, his husband didn't know about it. At one point, a judge told him, "You will die in prison." And these are the words that become the title of his book on the experience. And he's with us to share his story. And it's a story of unbelievable, incredible strength and perseverance. Bernard Phelan, welcome.
Thank you, Oliver.
And welcome home.
Thank you.
It's never too late to keep saying that, I suppose, over and over again. Can we find out who you are, first of all? Because you were based really in France when this happened, but you grew up and you're born and bred here.
I was born in Clonmel in Tipperary.
Oh, yeah.
And most of my life in Stillorgan in Dublin. And I moved to France in 86 with the Irish Tourist Board. And then was in IT after that in France. I stayed on and got married in France and married to my husband, Roland. And I was always fascinated by Iran.
Yeah.
The culture, the whole country always interested me, and went to see it in 2017. Fell in love with it. And I contacted the tour operator who was locally, who was involved in the trek I was doing. I said, "Listen, do you want some helping in marketing?" And he said, "We'll get back to you." And in October 2017, he said, "Yeah, we'd like you to help us."
And you had a history in tourism, obviously.
Absolutely. Selling different difficult destinations. Ireland in the 1980s. Ireland in the 1980s was a difficult destination to sell in France.
Yeah. Yeah.
People mix up with the north.
What attracted you to Iran? You said it was a place you fell in love with. How did you fall in love with Iran?
The people are fantastic.
Really?
It reminded me of Ireland back in the 80s. The people are terribly friendly, open. Their culture is so incredible. I mean, you find people reading literature. They know more about European literature than most people would know.
Yeah.
You go down to the metro station. I remember talking to a guy, said to us, "Where are you from?" I said, "Oh, we're from France." "Oh, yes, I'm reading Montaigne." I said, "What? You're reading a French philosopher?" This is a guy working in the metro. It's the whole culture in Iran is incredible.
So it's not the view we sometimes get, because obviously we cover political situations and we forget the kind of social, cultural life that goes on. Citizens are not their governments.
No, exactly. I mean, I meet people walk up to us when in Iran and would say, "We don't like our government."
Really?
Yeah, in a restaurant.
Confidently?
Yeah, confidently.
Okay.
And that was amazed us. You know, the middle class, Iranian middle class, are very well educated. And it's a very modern country. It's not like I've been in Algeria, I've been around the Middle East. Iran is the Germany of the Middle East and Central Asia.
Wow.
It is high tech, very, very modern. It's not at all the image people
nice
have.
Nice cars driving around,
yeah.
Restaurants in full.
Absolutely, yeah.
Full flow and so on. How did you market Ireland to the French in the 80s? I'm sorry to step back, but
that was difficult. I mean, everything wasn't difficult to sell. But the big problem was to try to explain to the public that Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland were two different places.
Yes.
That was the education. But in Iran, which was an amazing thing, everybody knew that Ireland was two countries. In the prison,
okay.
A guard would say, "Where are you from?" "Ireland, north or south?" You know the difference,
wow. Yeah.
In provincial Iran.
Yeah. So what's going on in your life at the time that you go to Iran and the bad incident comes where you're approached? You're living in Paris.
Yeah.
And how long have you been with your husband?
Nearly 20 years.
Oh, really? How did you meet?
Ooh, long story. Long story. I was with somebody else beforehand and he died of AIDS. And I met Roland and we just got on like a house on fire, and we've been together since. And when you go through something like this, it's, you know what love means.
Yeah.
It's I was just amazed, you know, how many, my sister and family and Roland, how much they battled for me. And I didn't know, of course, when I was in prison what was going on.
Yeah.
But when I found out about it, when I got out, it just bowled me over.
That became the harbour for you.
Yeah.
I presume living openly, coming from Paris, living openly as a gay man with a husband and everything, is Iran a country that you can travel safely in?
It is. I mean, we've been to Iran twice. I've been twice with Roland. And nobody would bat an eyelid when you go to a hotel and you want a double room.
Really?
No problem. It's not a problem for you Europeans. Mm-hmm. The Iranians, I mean, what flabbergasted, amazed me was at the interrogation, the first, second day in solitary confinement, the guard came, the interrogator said to me, "Are you married? Who are you married to?" And I said, "Roland Bonello." And he said, "That's a man's name." I said, "Yes, we can marry people of the same sex in many European countries." Next question, "Do you have children?" "No." "Why not? Why did you not adopt?" Totally
extraordinary,
open.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. I was
so
amazed.
They weren't shocked or gasping.
No. And another stage, as another interrogator, he said to me, "The LGBT lobby is very powerful in Europe." And I said, "Yes, they are."
We'll come to the situation in prison, but I want to visit that day, because you're over and back to Iran, as you described, as a tour operator. What exactly are you doing in September 2022?
I was helping my Iranian client, Adventure Iran, to work on a program to do the Silk Road by train. Mm-hmm. I'd flown into Istanbul. I travelled by train to Ankara, to Iranian border. He'd met me on the 17th of September. And when we travelled around northern Iran to Mashhad, where I was arrested this day, 2 years ago, at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Wow.
It's today.
This day?
This day, yeah.
It's 2 years ago?
Yeah.
That's extremely recently.
Yeah, yeah.
But it probably feels like 10 years to you.
No, it doesn't. It feels pretty fresh.
What happens?
Mike was, which is my Iranian pal, his nickname, was taking photographs of the Mashhad has the biggest mosque in Iran, mm-hmm. Where the prophet is buried, Iman Reza. And Mike was taking pictures in the evening with his big Canon camera of the mosques, floodlit, etc. Mm-hmm. And he was finishing up and I was waiting for him. And we were walking away and these two men in plain clothes walked up to us. One of them flashed the card at Mike and said, "Please follow us." And we walked a few metres away and we sat down on a wall. And they started asking questions, "Where are you from and who are you?" And I handed them my two passports, my Irish passport and my French passport. And they went away. One of them went away, came back, asked us for our telephones, went away, came back with some other guys. And they said, "We have to go to someplace else to talk in more, in better circumstances." And they took us about 5 minute walk to a prayer room. And there the interrogation started, alternating between me and Iranian. Mm-hmm. And that went on for about 2 or 3 hours. And then they said, "We have to go to someplace else." And they said, "Oh, the two of you." But that was the last time I saw my Iranian friend. We were separated.
Really?
He said, "He'll go down the stairs first, you'll go down next." Got into a car, handed a blindfold, handcuffs, and into an interrogation centre. I was brought into a first cell. There was a young Iranian guy in the corner, dressed in white shirt. I started walking towards him and the door opened, took me out, took me to another cell where there were two Iranians, one who spoke English. I said, "Why are you here?" And he held up his fist. He said, "I'm a protester."
Right.
And 5 minutes later, the guards came and took them away because I think they were speaking English. And that night, they were lying on the floor with just a blanket, and I heard a door, the other cell opening, and the next thing, shouting and somebody hitting somebody with a truncheon, and the guy screaming. And I knew then I was in trouble.
You're in a very bad place.
Yeah,
utterly terrifying.
Quite, yeah. I knew nothing was. I wasn't afraid that something physically was going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. I knew the Iranians were concerned that the hostages would be in good health. We are valuable merchandise. They don't want us to fall ill. They don't want us to get injured. But the psychological torture was really hard.
Explain to us what you mean by being valuable merchandise.
I discovered when I came to Ireland after I was out, and I met Micheál Martin and the people in the department, and it was said, quite clearly, if your visa had been on your Irish passport, you would not have been arrested. Mm. The Iranians basically have a shopping list, and they wanted French hostages. They wanted a Swedish hostage, they wanted a Belgian hostage, because there were Iranians in prison in Sweden, there was an Iranian prison in Belgium. And that's how it works.
It's a swap, prison swap. So they're looking
for... Or for money. There was an American in prison and he was released, and the Americans unblocked funds which were blocked in South Korea. It's just a shopping list. It's hostage diplomacy.
Wow. So you had a French passport. You were travelling, so they thought they were lifting. Well, you are a French citizen.
I'm a French dual national. But I every time somebody asks me, where are you from? I say, I'm Irish, to the Iranians. But from a legal point of view, the visa was on the French passport.
Was there not a reaction when you were saying, I'm Irish?
There was a smile. There was a smile because the Iranians have a very good opinion of Ireland because we're sort of pro-Palestinian and we're not a colony. Every time I was in Iran and you'd say to people you were Irish, the big smile. People were happy you were Irish. You're not English or you're not
American. Not a colonizer.
Not a colonizer.
Yeah. So that, but it didn't work in this case.
No, this I was French from the authorities' point of view.
And the charges when they were put to you?
The charges, I didn't have any charges initially. It took quite a while before they mounted up when I was accused. I was accused of supplying information, sending information to an enemy state. And I said to the judge, is France an enemy? And he said to me, not yet.
Really? Okay. You mentioned as well they want their hostages to be in good condition. You had a couple of health issues anyway going there. So you made this kind of extraordinary decision to essentially make yourself unwell.
Absolutely. I have a heart condition and HIV, etc. And I decided right from the beginning I have to make myself more ill to make them get me out. Mm. So from day one, I still had a bit of medication left. And in the interrogation centre, the guards would come to me, give me my medicine, have to drink it in front of them. And I put it under my tongue. And then when they closed the trap, I'd go into the toilet, spit it out. And then later on in prison, I would be taken down to medical centre every day for take my medicine, and the treatment for my heart condition, I'd throw down a toilet. So I never took it for the whole 7.5 months. I didn't take any treatment for my heart condition, and it really blew the doctors in the hospital, in the clinic. They were, you know, a very, very hard, high heart rate, and they were saying, you have to take something, you have to take something. Mm. I said, I'm not taking anything.
So when you did make yourself extra unwell, and this is the hope that you get out of prison because of the condition you're in. But did they bring you to a clinic?
There was a clinic in the prison. Prison in Mashhad, there was a prison with 20,000 prisoners.
Wow.
And a full-blown medical centre, and which I went to visit every evening to take my blood pressure. And the very good doctor there, Dr. Honey, was looking after me. And regularly, to take the blood pressure, and the nurse would come out and say, your blood pressure is too high, you have to take something else. And I refused. I said, I'm not taking any of your medicine.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the prison now. 20,000 people there. The conditions, I presume, are pretty awful.
We were in a separate block. We were in a block called 6-1, which was called Satan's Block, which was exclusively political prisoners. There were doctors, politicians, there was a judge, youngsters who'd been in protest. There was one cell with about 25 young guys, about 17, 18. They weren't allowed to leave their cell. They weren't allowed to go to the kitchen, weren't allowed to phone, weren't allowed in the courtyard. They were kept there all the time.
Oh.
And our block also had the two cells for executions. Mm-hmm. So any prisoner who was going to be executed the next morning after prayers, we'd be brought to our block. And that was very difficult because you heard the guys crying in their cell. The phones would be cut in our block, so the families couldn't phone to say your husband, your father or your brother is going to be executed tomorrow morning.
Good Lord, really?
Yeah, that was difficult.
What's going through your mind in this day? At this stage, do you have your charges sentencing?
I haven't got my charges sentencing yet. But the idea that, you know, Iran is the second country after China in terms of executions in the world.
Really?
I read recently they have done so far 700 executions. But I heard there were a lot of people killed during the protests and horrible circumstances. But
these are the protesters who remind people where a young woman, she'd refused to wear a headscarf.
Yeah.
She's arrested and she dies.
That dies in under the morality police.
And it sparks enormous protests.
Enormous protests.
For a time.
One of which I come across in Tabriz in the north of Iran. And trying to get back to the hotel with my Iranian pal, and we got caught up in the protest. And you see guys being arrested on motorbikes. The police are on unmarked motorbikes, and they pick up a young man and they put the young guy between the two guys in the motorbike and drive off. And you hear gunshots, except they're real gunshots. Mm-hmm. And remember trying to get the metro and crossing a square, and there was a van burning and there were people running all over the place, and there was a smell of tear gas, and we're running to get to the metro station. A woman says the metro's closed, it's been closed down, to go back, and trying to get back to the hotel, just very complicated.
Sure. So quite a few of those protesters are in the prison.
Yeah.
The political prisoners. Day to day, then what you have to make your own food?
No, we had prison food.
Okay.
Which is pretty terrible. But we had there was a small little shop in our block, and we could buy food, vegetables, and we would in the afternoon with the other prisoners, we'd get prepared vegetables in the cell, and then in the evening we'd go down and cook it.
You've no mattresses in the beds?
No. The bed had a wire frame and just a blanket folded over, which was made up of mattress. Yeah. I hadn't got a good back originally, and my back is in terrible state since.
And the winters are extremely cold.
Yeah, it was the coldest winter in Mashhad for 10 years. And the Irish had tried to send me hot water bottles.
Really?
And the hot water bottles were not allowed. And so we had to, the Iranians had the technique, they have Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is still sold in Iran.
Right, okay.
Even despite sanctions.
Yeah.
And we filled the Coca-Cola bottle with hot water and put that in the bed.
Right.
And we'd spend the day in bed rest because of the cold.
Desperately trying to keep warm.
Yeah.
You can feel the cold
in
that section of the book. Absolutely. It's amazing that you have an account in the book, because it reads like you were able to keep a diary, but that's out of the question.
Yeah, because I was told right from the beginning you'd never be able to take anything out. So I wrote down a diary, and I dictated through Justin in Tehran, or the French embassy. I dictated information back to friends in France, and you made up a code, which I dictated back. For example, I say, you know, 2DR, and that was 2 on death row, 2 prisons executed today. And I was able to get information like that back.
So when you're talking on the phone, the authorities don't know what you're saying?
Not quite what we're saying. I mean, they're listening into the conversation. Yeah. And when you're speaking on the phone, there's a recorded message every minute or 2 minutes saying, this call is coming from a prisoner. This call is coming from a prisoner.
Okay. Just in case anyone doesn't know. You do get to have calls. How often do you get to speak to family?
I was able to. No, family. Iranian law says foreign prisoners must be able to speak to the family once a week. In the 7 months, I had maybe 4 calls to my family.
Wow.
One call to my father. I think 2 calls to Roland. Maybe a call to my sister.
You know now what was going on in their lives, but a very harrowing and worrying time for them.
Yeah, very, very.
Annoying.
I mean, as Roland, my husband, said, you know, I'm the hostage, but Roland's the hostage, Caroline's the hostage, my father's a hostage. I mean, when you go to prison, the only book I've read, first book I read when I came out was about prison in England or Ireland, because I was just curious, what's prison like here? When you're a prisoner in the West, you know when you're going to get out. You have a date.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know when we were going to get out.
Impossible
to
stare at that kind of blackness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You were on hunger strike at one stage.
Yeah.
And your father's intervention is very important here.
Yeah, I was so desperate to try and, you know, get them to do something, to, you know, wake them up. And, my blood pressure was bad. I wasn't in good health. My back was giving trouble. And Benjamin, my French co-hostage, had already done a hunger strike. And I said to myself, I'm going to do a hunger strike. And handed in my medication. I said, I'm not taking any more medicine. They didn't want to take it. I filled in the form in the prison. and went on hunger strike. It was difficult at the beginning. I got used to not eating and not hanging around food. I was drinking tomato juice and sweet tea. I was getting messages from family and friends, stop, stop, stop. I wasn't going to stop. And then I got an email, a message from my dad, and he said, please stop. Mm-hmm. He was 97. I'd already lost my brother a long time, my younger brother, to illness a few years before.
That's Declan.
Declan. And the idea for my father of losing another son, was just too much for him. So I stopped.
He was 97. Is your dad still?
Still in good form. So, he's 98. He'll be 99 in next month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. He's seen a lot in 2 years.
Yeah, he has.
He's been around nearly a century.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and discuss the release, the relief as well of that story. People are getting in touch on WhatsApp at the moment. We have a new WhatsApp number, 087-032-3232. And actually, I'll share this one with you while I'm at it because it's come in through WhatsApp. Fascinating discussion with Bernard. Among those suffering repression in Iran are the religious minorities. Many members of the Baha'i faith are in prison and also Christians. I wonder if Bernard came up against any of this aspect of repression while in prison in Iran. Ask Brendan. You're nodding away.
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah, because the, not so much the Baha'i, but the, Iran is a Shia country.
Yeah. It's not an Arab state. They speak Farsi. They speak Farsi. Strand of Islam.
And Sunnis are persecuted. And in my block, when I would go down to the medical centre in the evening, there was a Sunni prisoner who was on hunger strike for quite a long time. He was quite weak and I'd help him go up the stairs. He was a Shia Muslim, converted to Sunni, 20 years prison.
Good Lord.
Just conversion.
Just for that.
Yeah.
That's the level of repression. Mm-hmm. We will take a quick break and we'll be back very shortly. Now, welcome back. We're still here with Bernard Phelan, who's talking about his time as a state hostage in Iran. I was wondering how difficult it was. We talked about repression against religious faiths in Iran if you're not a Shia Muslim. But being a gay man, are you able to say in prison, I'm a gay man? Would that not invite...
I didn't say it openly to the other prisoners. Mm-hmm. During the interrogation, I was quite open. I was married. I had a husband. I was gay. I didn't hide it. I mean, I know how Iranian state treats gay Iranian people. They hang them from cranes. It's a horrible regime.
Gosh, yeah.
But I wasn't worried any harm would come to me because I was gay. And when I was in prison, I knew that was an arm for getting me out and trying to sort of tell my sister and Roland back here in Europe, use that to talk about me. But of course, they were afraid. Everybody's afraid if they said I was gay openly on media in the West, it had repercussions in Iran.
Yeah.
And I knew it wouldn't have repercussions. The fact that they were persecuting women and if the media had come out in Europe to say there's a gay man in prison from Europe in Iran, it would have hit the headlines.
Yes, and it'd be diplomatically very difficult.
Exactly,
for
the Iranians.
Just as the repression of women in those protests was difficult for Iran, but didn't seem to stop them. People are asking, did you have access to a solicitor? That's Siobhan. And that brings us neatly to what passes for the judicial process.
It was a joke. I had a lawyer, Miss Halimi, who's a wonderful woman, very small. She ate the faces of the people in the prison when I met her. And she was also Benjamin's lawyer. But the Revolutionary Court refused to recognise her as my lawyer. And they forced another lawyer on me, who I refused to accept. But, I mean, the judicial process is just a joke. I mean, my member Caroline said to me on the phone, we're going to get a good lawyer here in Europe and going to fight against it. I said, well, don't waste your money.
Caroline's your sister.
My sister. Yeah. And I said, the judicial process in Iran is just a joke.
So, because you're dual citizenship, it's the French that lead in the negotiations regarding your release. How does it come about, ultimately?
Well, I'm not sure who... I don't know the exact details of the negotiations, but the French and Irish... I understand the Irish sent out a team very shortly after I was arrested to Tehran, and the French were doing most of the negotiations, and we saw regularly the French ambassador would come on a consular visit to the prison, and the Irish, I understood afterwards that they were more involved with the Iranians right. in the negotiating. And I met the Irish ambassador to Iran, based in Ankara, Sonia McGuinness. I remember on the 1st of May, I'll never forget that meeting. She had a wonderful smile when I went brought into the room with the guard, and she rushes up to me and hugs me, and the guard is flabbergasted because men and women can't touch each other in Iran if they're not family.
I see.
And she gives me a big hug, and we got chatting. And I said to Sonia, I said, listen, I can't take much more of this. Everybody's telling us to keep quiet. The French are telling us to stay quiet, don't upset the Iranians. The Irish said, don't upset the Iranians. I said, I'm going to upset them. I'm giving you till the 15th of May. And it's going to be a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And I was released on the 11th.
That day of the release?
Yes, because it was an amazing day. But at the same time, Benjamin had been falsely released earlier that year. I remember the loudspeaker coming out, Benjamin is free, and everybody applauding. So we were taken down to security. We didn't know anything. And we're taken to the director of security, and he sits down. He says, you're going to be released today. And he says, you have to write a letter saying that you will be not attack the Iranian state or the prison for mistreatment. Mm. And both of us, without talking to each other, said, no, we're not going to write that letter. He said, okay. Go back to your cells.
A crushing day. So you were worried that maybe...
what was going to happen?
It can be reversed.
Yeah.
But you do finally get home and your husband, your sister, your family. I mean, it's just incredible. It must be the most incredible moment that you will
most incredible match. Moment in my life. I mean, coming down the steps of that plane and hearing Roland shouting, Mon Bernard, my Bernard. It's my sister. It's just so wonderful. It
gets you still.
Yeah, it gets me still.
I want to mention just before we finish that Justin Ryan, the Irish diplomat, and Nicolas Roche, I presume how you pronounce the French ambassador they're mentioned throughout, and they're the key colour. Because we mentioned the politicians, but it is the guys behind that do a lot of the work. We've just out of time, Bernard, but there's a lovely message. Maureen in Cork is reading your book at the moment and commend your bravery. Wish you well for continuing recovery, which will doubtless be long term. Good luck with the book launch this evening. Where are you launching the book? Is that
Dubray's Bookshop in Grafton Street, 6:30.
Perfect place. You Will Die in Prison is the stark title, but Bernard Phelan is here in front of us, alive and well.
Alive and well, and hopefully there's going to be a documentary.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, they started doing some filming work as well, so, you know.
You're able to talk.
I'm able to talk. No problem.
And hopefully you can hold it together, because it's difficult.
Yeah.
Bernard, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks, Oliver.
And good luck to you and Roland for long days ahead. Back after these.